Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with the New York State Certified Seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It's a kind of gloomy Sunday here in Brooklyn, but I am really excited because I have the delightful presence of a wonderful James Beard Award-winning cookbook author, and she's one of the most prolific cookbook authors and food journalists there are. And she came from across the pond just for this interview. I'm just kidding. Okay, good, good. Excellent. And that would be Diana Henry. Thank you so much for joining.
It's good to be here.
Your latest book is called Simple, Effortless Food, Big Flavors. You may have seen some of her previous books. There was the, as we mentioned, the James Beard Award-winning A Bird in the Hand. There's A Change of Appetite, Salt, Sugar, Smoke, Roast Figs, Sugar Snow, Crazy Water, Pickled Lemons. I just love the titles. I just love reading them. So
a good title is really important, I think.
Isn't it?
Sometimes the book will start with a title. It's not so good if you have to struggle to find one. When I did Crazy Water, Pickled Lemons, I had lots with the first book I wrote. I had quite a lot of recipes in my head because it was about food that was had enchanted me. I grew up in Ireland, so there was nothing exotic, but reading things like the Arabian Nights. So I started to kind of long for ingredients like figs and pomegranates. So I had an idea of the kind of food that would be, but then Crazy Water is an actual dish that's served on the Amalfi Coast. It's a fish dish. And then pickled lemons, preserved lemons, something they have in North Africa. And I put those two things together, and that seemed to be just kind of really capture that kind of food. That title seemed to say that to me.
It's evocative
and romantic.
Title.
Yeah.
And it's very striking for, you know, I think it says a lot about your style of food writing. It's very emotional. It's very, it's just lovely and descriptive. And it's personal too.
It is very personal. It's funny because I think Americans are more comfortable with that than we've been in the UK. With that first book, which in fact has been selling and is still selling, it's become a kind of like classic among people who love food. But some reviewers said, oh, it's all about I. She's always talking about what she thinks. It's like, well, what else would I be writing about? So I think it was hard to get that voice accepted in the UK. And I like a lot of American food writers, and I think they're much more comfortable with the personal and emotional approach to food. And, you know, food is not just something we eat. It is about memory and imagination and where you come from. So, and I want to read other people's personal feelings about it and their reactions to it. So I just wrote really what I wanted to read.
Right. That's really a good point. You know, food recipes didn't come from some, like, I guess, you know, scholarly text or Bible. It came from somebody's imagination.
Well, there's that. And also recipes come from, you know, a cultural context. And I always love to hear whether it's a traditional recipe that a writer has picked up and they've changed it slightly, or whether it's something that comes out of their heads completely. I love to know what inspired dishes or where they've come from. I think recipes in a context is what I love reading about that. I would never try to go online to find recipes because, yeah, they're recipes, but they're not part of anything.
Right.
And, you know, they might work and they'll get supper on the table maybe. But the whole joy of food, I think, is where it comes from.
Absolutely, the context that connects you to, like, why do I care? Why should I care about this dish?
Well, and I think recipes particularly are about connectedness. Heidi Swanson, it's a very good quote. She said once that recipes intersect our lives. And I think that's really true. And before I even started writing about food, when I went on holidays or I went to, you know, abroad, I would try, if I could, to kind of talk my way into somebody's home kitchen. I certainly would talk about food to the people I met. And I'd come back home after holidays with, you know, recipes in my pockets.
Yeah.
And now I just do that, but I collect more of them. But that way that you're connected to someone who gives you one of their recipes and maybe you give them one of yours. It's from my home to yours and from my country to yours. I like that. I think that's a very special thing about food.
And it's the truth. It really is. So so you mentioned Heidi Swanson, 101 Cookbooks, a prolific blogger.
Yeah.
What other food writing idols or mentors have you had?
Oh, in the States?
Or actually anywhere.
Here, I love John Thorne. Mm-hmm. Calvin Trilling, Molly O'Neill. She's a great writer, I think. I know she doesn't write for the New York Times anymore, but I think she's, her prose is wonderful. And in terms of kind of influence, it would be, this sounds kind of mad for someone from Ireland, but it would be Californian. When I first discovered Alice Waters' Chez Panisse menu cookbook, we in London, we were in the middle of Nouvelle Cuisine. So it was hexagonal plates and really reduced stock sauces. And I was always buying veal bones to make stock. And then I found Alice's book. And the first menu that I hit on, I think it was goat's cheese with roast garlic and sourdough. And then she had roast pork with charred peppers. And then for dessert, she was just suggesting a bowl of cherries and almond cookies. And that was revolutionary from where we were at that time.
Yeah.
And a kind of shiver did go down my spine at the magicalness of a menu that simple, very clear flavors and a sense of place as well. It was kind of Mediterranean inspired, but it was very Californian.
It was definitely very opinionated. It had a strong point of view.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Well, that influenced me. And I love Joyce Goldstein, who works there as well. Mm-hmm. And Judy Rogers from the Zuni Cafe. So as soon as I discovered Alice, I kept a big eye on what was happening over there. And she's had, I mean, that whole kind of Californian approach that led to the local seasonal kind of mantra, which we all have, you know, in lots of countries now. That's, I think that's where it came from. So we have, I think in the UK, we have a debt to Californian food that's not always credited.
Interesting. Yeah. And you mentioned in the beginning of your book that the uncommon ingredients has really grown in the UK in the past decade or so.
Yes.
And that sometimes is divisive. So some people are delighted to hear about recipes with like pomegranate molasses and others are like, but this is not something I can just grab. I have to go hunt, you know, complain.
I get about 2/3 who really want to go and find new ingredients and about 1/3 who really moan about it. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty with that is, if I'm writing a cookbook, there's no point in me putting in, you know, how to make shepherd's pie or fish cakes. Most people already know, and it's been done in lots of books. So I do think, and it's just my approach, I mean, in among all the kind of Irish and British traditional dishes I do, I've always loved to kind of suck up other cultures, and that means having other ingredients.
And explore through tasting and cooking yourself.
Yeah, well, if you are at home and cooking every day for a family or even just for you and your partner, you want to try new things. But also it is about tasting a culture, which is something I really love to do.
Yeah.
I mean, my larder, my store cupboard at home, it's divided up into sections according to where the food is from. So I have got a big Middle Eastern section. So when there's the pomegranate molasses, the sumac, the preserved lemons and everything, I've got Spanish stuff. I've got Italian stuff. I've got a French section. There's a growing Scandinavian section. So sometimes, you know, when you're trying to think about supper tonight, you go in there and you think, you know what you have in the fridge that's fresh, but also you look and you think, where can I go with this?
Right.
So the thing of kind of moaning about not being able to get things, I don't quite understand it. Because certainly in the UK, in most supermarkets, you can get most things and you can get anything online.
And some of
now.
These things are just pantry staples. They last forever. Actually,
they'll just stay there.
Spices,
you'll keep that. Yes. And
so
you'll be
forth.
Able to keep using them.
And as we saw a great little description of your spice rack and your kitchen recently in the New York Times with a profile by Melissa Clark. So congrats. That was really fun.
She did look in my store cupboard.
Yeah. Okay. So, Diana, I have to ask this now that we're on the topic of cultural, international cuisines and how much that's really blowing up in everyday kitchens, but also in restaurants. There has been a bit of a discussion around the media over the question of, you know, what happens when a chef cooks a cuisine outside their heritage? You know, where is there a line, or is there a line crossing into something that may be called cultural exploitation? That is, it's a newish fad buzzword.
It's something that I've been sort of concerned about, but not because I thought somebody was possessing something else that they shouldn't. I just would like to be sure that somebody knows what they're doing, that they understand the cuisine sufficiently, that they're turning out good food.
Yeah.
But I see, the UK, we have taken stuff from everywhere since the Middle Ages. So, you know, spices that went into our Christmas pudding and a lot of the stuff that we like, when you think
curries.
That was kind of later, but even early on, we liked sweet things with savory meats, which is very Arabic. So we were already kind of influenced by that kind of stuff.
Oh, interesting.
And then later on, yeah, we've had Indian and Pakistani people coming in, and now chicken tikka masala is said to be the most favorite, you know, everyone's favorite dish in the UK.
Yeah.
And it has never been felt that we are taking these things that we shouldn't, but it's come in as a big whole. And I don't think you can stop the flow of things from country to country and culture to culture. I'm not even sure why you'd want to. Nobody's kind of saying we're taking this and we're owning it and you can't have it anymore. I just think in history, the whole kind of the development of food and the kind of evolution of dishes has had to do with kind of crossing cultures. So to stop that or to ban it or to be too aware of it, I think it's just not natural in a way.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great perception to just kind of step back for a moment and just look at this whole evolution instead of, you know, focusing on this one chef and what he's doing and so forth.
People feel that it's wrong? Is there...
There has been some controversies lately, with... just kind of blanking on his name,
yeah.
Mexican restaurateur,
okay.
Who is an American.
Yeah.
So there was, and then there was a Bon Appetit video showing a chef who was American creating a pho dish and giving a sort of instructional how-to of that people had a problem with, and they took it down. Bon Appetit. Yeah.
It isn't such an issue in the UK. And I think there's kind of crossover between cultures.
Maybe different
all
attitudes.
The time. I think we've been a very magpie culture in our own food history. We take things from everywhere, and there's a real embracing of other people's, of other people's ingredients. We get very excited about it. I mean, it's partly because I think our own British food is it's not huge. We don't have... I couldn't sit here and name you 30 dishes that are in the kind of core British repertoire of classic dishes. So we've always taken stuff from elsewhere. But I think in a very positive way and in a very embracing way.
In a delicious way.
Yes.
As we've seen in your cookbook. Thanks for shedding light on that. I always just love to ask people what their thoughts are. It's all over the place. So this book is called Simple, Effortless Food, Big Flavors. It is your 10th book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, what made you land on this simple route this time?
I think that people think, even people who are involved in food like me, when you have to get supper or dinner on the table every day, I think it's hard to have ideas that aren't very time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we think in building blocks. So the book is structured into kind of chops, sausages, fillets of fish. And I think even though that seems dull, I think that's where most people start when they think about the evening meal. So then I wanted to take those and look at ways that they could be transformed into something that was a bit special, but without making too much effort. It's not a book of quick cooking, because I think our focus on quick cooking means we think something you stand there and do for 15 to 20 minutes, maybe it's a stir fry, lots of chopping, and then it's on the table. In a way, I like food that's even easier than that, because I want stuff that you can do in about 10 to 15 minutes and no use stick it in the oven or it's on the hob. And then you can go and open a bottle of wine or check your mail or, you know, deal with your children or whatever. But while you're doing that, the heat either of your hob or of your oven is doing the work. So that's the thing that's doing the transforming. You're not having to have very much kind of hands-on care on that dish at all. So that is what's in the book. It's when I say effortless, I really mean short amount of time at your kitchen counter. Then you go and do something. Might take an hour for the thing to actually cook, but you haven't done very much.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that kind of cook. I love using my oven. I don't think we use our ovens enough. I mean, if you're kind of cooking chicken thighs, maybe with sweet potatoes and wedges of onion, and you put some smoked paprika on it, olive oil, you get it in the oven. And when it goes in, it doesn't look like much. I mean, I don't even brown this chicken, but as long as it's all in a single layer, it will all cook at the same time. And then you take something out after 45 minutes, maybe put some feta on it, maybe coriander, slivers of preserved lemon. You have got a dish which is
maybe
really full of different flavors.
Some crusty bread and just dip it in there.
And it's and it has the heat of the oven has completely transformed this dish without you doing very much at all. And I do love that kind of cooking, especially during the week.
I definitely want to talk more about this, the building blocks philosophy, which I think is very helpful, and much more of your recipes after a quick little commercial interlude. We'll be right back.
New York chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
All right, we're back with Diana Henry, whose latest book is Simple, Effortless Food, Big Flavors. So we were just talking a little bit about the idea of building blocks to create a meal around and kind of thinking. I think that's like a really great way to kind of put you on a path of not having to think as much next time and, you know, not having to do everything from all over, you know, just going through recipes, ingredients and so forth. So do you find that people, I think that certainly in the U.S. and, you know, I've been commenting on this for a while, they don't really cook as much these days or as, let's say, not as often as, I don't know, our parents' time. What is it like in the UK? Do you think that that's...
I think there's a kind of problem. It's similarly in that we watch loads of TV shows, we buy loads of cookbooks, and people feel they're too tired or too time short to do things in the evening. It's one of the reasons I wanted a book like this one to be... to make it feel doable for people. I really think, and I understand the time thing.
It's the biggest challenge, the time.
Yeah, I think that, and I think ideas are short as well. People kind of, so then it's just easier to get a takeaway if you can't think, what will I do with chops? What will I do with chicken? But I really honestly think that if you do not do some cooking every day, I think you're missing out on the sensual pleasures in life. I mean, this is the easiest supper I will do, and I would take this above quite a few more complicated dishes. Would be spaghetti with, you just saute sliced garlic in olive oil, just let it scald, don't let it go anymore. Dry chili flakes, which you might have in your cupboard, chopped parsley, lemon zest and lemon juice, and then more olive oil, a good one, an extra virgin to pour on it when you've tossed it all together, and your Parmesan. And that is a delicious supper to me. That's lovely. But as well as sitting down to eat it, while I've been cooking, I've had the smell of garlic. I've had the spray of lemon oil as I've cut into the lemon. When you chop parsley, it has that lovely green, fresh herbal smell. So in a way, you've been partly fed before you sit down to eat. Mm-hmm. And I know when there have been times when I worked in television and I was either in a studio or in an office, that when I had very long hours, I might have kind of had something very easy or maybe even had a ready meal in the evening. And after you do that for a week, you start to feel, well, I did start to feel quite low. There's something missing.
Yeah.
And I think the connection with actual fresh food every day, I think it's good for people. I mean, I understand that not everybody feels comfortable in the kitchen, But I think it's a bit like saying, oh, I never take walks. I don't walk. That's not the kind of thing I do. I don't want to go for walks in the country. I think cooking is a similar kind of thing in that it's not really, you're missing out badly. It's not really an optional thing. I think it's a life thing that is good for you physically, but also good for you psychologically as well.
Right. And not to go too crazy, you know, all at once, not to like pour yourself into too much work, but just take these things in stride and, you know.
Yeah, I think that there are plenty of dishes that can be done very easily by people who do not feel that they're very good cooks at all. That this simple, the one I've just written, was slightly a follow-up to a book I did in about 2004 called Cook Simple.
Right.
And that was really mostly dishes that you bunged in the oven. And I started that kind of cooking when I had my first child because it was, he cried all the time. I was always kind of like, what can I do with basically one hand? And I got a great response to that book. People who said, I can actually burn water. I can't cook anything, but I can cook from that book. And
I could relate
works.
To it too.
Yeah. You know? And I don't.
And you really do, you know, walk the walk and talk the talk.
I do not want people to feel they can't do it. Mm-hmm. I really want people to cook because I think it's a joy.
Yeah. So tell me, what do you think of the phenomenon of meal kits growing in popularity?
I'm not a fan. Well, because I think any of those things which we become dependent on, then we're not kind of doing things for ourselves. I think it's funny that we live in a culture which is broadly nowadays, certainly in the UK, and I would say here as well, where we want to be able to do things. We want to be in control. We want to be creative ourselves. And running alongside that is this kind of giving up of our autonomy via ready meals or fast food or meal kits to other people who are going to make those for us. You know, since the beginning of the human race, we've had to feed ourselves. And I think everybody has to learn to do that for themselves.
Yeah. It's sort of like just outsourcing it, but in a different way. You know, instead of the takeout meal, it's just this thing that will solve.
Well, I think that commercial concerns will always come up with kind of new spins on how they can help people with the evening meal, and people will always try them. It's not what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it has a lot of your cookbooks and food writing been focused on, you know, just it's. I love that you really focus and meditate on home cooking rather than.
I know, I love home cooking.
Yeah. So why is that? After all these years, all these books. You didn't stray into restaurant reviewing or something. I don't know.
Just home cooking.
Opening your own restaurant.
Oh, no, I hate that.
No.
Home cooking is just from a real place. And I'm interested in the people that the dishes come from as well as the dishes themselves. And I do like chefs. And we learn a lot from them in terms of technique. And I love going to restaurants. But I like real food that is rooted in the home, really, because it comes from somewhere.
Absolutely. So we didn't really talk too much about the wonderful home cooking that you shared in this book, and it really is something else. Okay, so talking about simple food, let's talk about this Ishita's chicken masala you mentioned discovered from somebody on Twitter.
Yeah.
This is a roast chicken that is rubbed with a lot of yummy spices.
Yep, and yogurt.
A nice little combination and yogurt. And then you have a spectacular roast chicken.
Oh, it's gorgeous. I mean, it's not just roast chicken. It's something completely different. Mm-hmm. So you can have with that some raita, some yogurt with a cucumber, maybe a fresh kind of chutney, and then rice. And that's it, really. But I'm really glad you picked that one out because Ishita is someone that I met on Twitter, and for ages I didn't even know she's called Food at Food with Mustard. So she lives in Bristol, but I thought for ages, you know, on Twitter you never actually know who you're dealing with. So I thought she was a kind of antiques dealer in her mid-40s, and I don't know why I thought that. And then when I met her, she's a kind of 26-year-old surgeon. She's a doctor who lives in Bristol, and she loves home cooking and she loves food. And one of the dishes that she tweeted one week that she'd cooked was her family's. That is a family recipe, her chicken masala. And I just said, can I have the recipe? I'd love this. So I think that's another nice thing. Nowadays, you don't even necessarily have to go, you know, on holidays or to another country. Mm-hmm. Someone, you'll just find someone on Twitter who's like you that you get on with, and they will share their recipe as well.
And it was definitely a passion project of hers to have this, you know, alter ego in addition to being a, what was it, a doctor?
Yeah, she's a doctor.
I mean, that's wild.
She loves food and she loves fiction, right. And I love both of those as well. So we had a lot to talk about on Twitter.
That's wonderful.
It's a good place to meet up for other people who are interested in food, I think. That's what I find it good for.
Let's keep in touch, Diana, on Twitter.
Yes, we must.
So unfortunately, that's about all the time we have for today. I know there's so much to go over. Do you have a favorite recipe that you're raring to cook right now?
There is a dish in there, okay, which is it's griddled chicken thighs with Turkish spices, and it has a tomato salsa on the side. So
perfect.
Tomato, onion, coriander, and parsley. And you just need to marinate the thighs for a little bit and then grill them. That's really nice. And if you add yogurt to that, because the salsa is actually quite spicy. But that is the kind of food that, you know, you eat that, it attacks the front of your mouth. Those flavors are quite big.
Mm-hmm.
That's my kind of, that's a lovely supper dish to me that doesn't take much time to do.
It's all about a great, you know, pantry staples.
I think a good pantry is important.
Put it together.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to try that soon, especially I don't use the oven enough. So you've really inspired me. Just let it go. Don't use the fry pan. So thank you so much for joining us,
Diana.
It's
been a pleasure.
I hope everyone checks out Simple, Effortless Food, Big Flavors, just out from Mitchell Beasley in the U.S. It's wonderful. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you.
And you can follow you on at Diana Henry.
At
Twitter.
Diana Henry Food.
Excellent. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.